Welcome to Women on Air, a weekly show about women, feminism, and social justice, brought to you by CFUV's Women's Radio Collective.
Action Coalition, and she's just on the line with me.
Hi, Trish, how are you doing?
Hi.
So, first off, you are the community organizer for the BC Poverty Reduction Coalition. Can you tell me what the BC Poverty Reduction Coalition does?
Yeah, certainly. Thanks for having me on the show today. Sorry, I have a bit of a cold, as a lot of people do. The Poverty Reduction Coalition does, we raise public awareness about the issues of poverty in BC, and we do direct political advocacy. We meet with politicians, and we encourage all our supporters around the province to meet with politicians to tell them that we would like to see a comprehensive poverty reduction strategy for BC. We're one of the last provinces without this kind of approach, this upfront plan, yet we have the highest poverty rate in Canada. So we do a lot of raising awareness and a lot of meeting with politicians. And we've now grown to over 400 organizations around the province who support this call, which represents hundreds of thousands of people. So we know we have a lot of support, a lot of strong support throughout BC for this.
Mm-hmm. And how would you define poverty, first off?
Well, that's an interesting question. We use a poverty line called the Low Income Cutoff. It's a poverty line produced by Statistics Canada. It's a mix of both what we call an absolute measure and a relative measure. So what it does is it takes sort of a basket of goods, like clothing and housing and that kind of thing, and then determines how much percentage of a family's income they spend on that basket, an average family, and then if they define poverty if you are spending 20% more of your income on that. We've chosen to use that one. It's a fairly conservative poverty line. There are poverty lines that would put the poverty rate much higher in BC, for instance. So we use it because it's a conservative measure and also because the provincial government now use it as well. So it's good when we're in dialogue with them that we're using the same measure.
And can you... That sounds good that it's in relation to what the politicians are referring to. Can you broadly outline the problem of income inequality in Canada and then particularly in BC and why we are kind of last on the scale and list there?
Yeah, definitely. Well, like I said, we have the highest poverty rate in Canada. We also have the highest child poverty rate as well. And these things aren't just blips. We've been consistently worse in terms of overall poverty rate and overall child poverty rate for the last over a decade. And then in terms of inequality, again, we're the worst in Canada. So the gap between the rich and the poor is the worst in BC. And most alarming, it's increasing at the highest rate across Canada. So what we see in terms of wealth, it's really shocking, the inequality. In BC, we're seeing the richest 20% of the population have 75% of the total wealth in BC, whereas the poorest 20% actually have nothing in terms of assets. They're, in general, in debt, about $9,000. In terms of income inequality, things are a little better, but not great. We're seeing 50% of the total income in BC going to that top 20%, that richest 20%, and then only about 4 or 5% of income going to the poorest 20%. So we're seeing a huge gap between rich and poor in BC, and things not getting any better.
Mm-hmm. What are the factors that are contributing to this increase in disparity? Like what's creating that?
Well, we used to do things a lot better to address inequality. It's it comes down to some sort of basic supports at the bottom, and then some tax and redistribution at the top to share out the wealth that we do have in BC. We're actually one of the wealthiest provinces, but we're not sharing it through our tax and transfer systems. So at the bottom, it comes down to really low welfare. Our welfare is set at $610 a month for a single employable person, and then just $900 for a person with disability. So very hard to survive on those kind of rates, and we haven't seen an increase there for the last 7 years. So what started out as a very low rate has been eaten away by inflation, so it's extremely hard, almost impossible to survive at that rate now. And then also low wages. So our minimum wage has gone up, but it's still not enough to lift someone above the poverty line. And then we're seeing on the other side of the income, we're seeing just a lack of investment in the social goods that we tend to take for granted as Canadians, but our governments aren't investing in them anymore. So social housing, you know, everyone's facing unaffordable rents. Universal childcare system like we have in Quebec, it would be great to have something like that here. More investment in education, healthcare. And then there are lots of groups that are overrepresented in poverty that are really facing much higher poverty rates. So some investments there in addressing Aboriginal poverty and people with disabilities, immigrants and refugees, single mothers, those kind of groups.
So I just want to go back to something that you mentioned earlier, that there's been a freeze on the welfare for about 7 years. Why is that? Why hasn't the rate increased along with inflation?
Well, that's a good question, Jen. I'm not sure. It's something that we push every year and continuously push throughout the year. It's shocking to me that it's so low. For a government that prides itself on jobs and trying to get people into employment, keeping the rates this low is a disincentive to employment. People are spending so many hours just lining up for food, for a place to sleep, that it's impossible to find a job. It's a question that we ask the government all the time. What they say to us is that they can't afford to do it right now. And our response to that is actually, when you look at the numbers, it's costing us so much more as a province to pay for the cost of poverty than it would if we actually had a comprehensive poverty reduction plan. It's kind of like we're dealing with the after effects of poverty in terms of healthcare costs, criminal justice costs, and all of those. They actually add up to about $8 to $9 billion per year that we're already spending. And if we put a plan in place with all of the good things I mentioned, it's only about half of that cost, about $3 to $4 billion.
So with those types of figures, why is there so little action on the part of our politicians who are supposed to be representing human interests?
Well, that's a good question again. I think the government seems to put a lot of emphasis on their jobs plan, like I said, and getting people into employment. But what we actually see is that most people living in poverty already have a job. And this is something we try and raise awareness about, because it counters those stereotypes that people often have around people in poverty. But we have about 11% of the population living in poverty, and only about 3% of that is on welfare. So it's really a low-wage story. It's really about people living in working poverty. So we continually ask them to raise the minimum wage to address that, to at least raise it to a figure above the poverty line. It just is intolerable that people working could be still living in poverty.
Absolutely. And you mentioned that there's lots of stereotypes. What are these common stereotypes and stigmas that you hear, and then what are your counter-arguments to them?
Well, that's a big one, the one I just mentioned around people. You know, people have an idea of poor people as being lazy, as, you know, if they just worked hard enough, they could pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, kind of kind of idea. And part of that response I've already mentioned that we have is just to highlight how many people are already working and already doing what the government's telling them to do with one or possibly two or three jobs. But what we're facing in the province right now is, as well as the low wage factor, a lot of really precarious contract work or part-time work, a lot of people having trouble finding really stable full-time work. So we try and push that response to that kind of stereotype.
And again, something that you mentioned is that people are spending their time lining up for food and housing and things like that. And we actually have quite a few people living with food instability. Can you speak to this problem in BC?
Yeah, we do. We have a lot of food insecurity in BC. I mean, it comes down to, like I said, the low welfare rates. We're hearing stories all the time of people who can't access good, healthy food on that rate. It's possible to eat, especially if you're in a place, whether you're in Vancouver or Victoria or an urban center, it's possible to eat and get by on that kind of welfare rate. Charities fill the gap that government's left, but it's impossible to eat healthily and really have a nutritious diet on that rate. There's a great report by the Dietitians of BC that calculates the cost of eating, and it's about $850 for a sort of an average family to eat a healthy food basket, and there's no way that a family on welfare or even a minimum wage family would be able to access that kind of good, nutritious food. And then what that leads into is health problems that then put a huge burden on our healthcare system. So like I said, it would be a lot better if we took a preventative approach to all of this. It's kind of like we've got a hole in the roof and we're continually mopping up the water on the floor, but we're not just taking that step back and fixing the hole in the roof and putting some money into this long-term investment.
Yeah, I remember talking with another interviewee about farming on the island, and for a long time, Vancouver Island was a self-sustaining food production area, and I know that the Fraser Valley is one of the most fertile land areas in Canada, so it seems inconceivable that we don't have enough food to feed everybody in the province.
Right.
And it's just a matter of making it affordable for everybody, I feel.
Right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, we're seeing the cost of living go up, like food and other basic expenses, hydro and that kind of thing. And it really is that affordability piece that people can't access it because they don't have the incomes to.
Do you think this is linked to global insecurity and distribution of wealth? I feel that a lot of the issues that we find local are also problems that we have globally with kind of a system that's a free market system that is slightly rigged in the favor of people who already have stable incomes and wealth. And do you see that connection in the work that you guys do?
Yeah, we do. We do keep track of what's happening on an international level, and we do see a lot of the same kind of things happening in the so-called developed countries that Canada might compare itself to. But there are other countries that we see a lot less inequality, a lot more equality, and a lot less of the health and social problems that go along with inequality. For instance, countries in Scandinavia are putting in, you know, a lot more social investment, a lot more public investment into their people and their supports and services. And it pays for itself in terms of people doing better, people living healthier lives, people living longer lives. Their education levels are higher, literacy levels, all sorts of health and social goods do better when countries are more equal. And so we do have examples out there where people are doing this better, where their governments are really stepping in and sharing the weight of poverty. Whereas here, what we're seeing is the community keeps stepping in for the lack of investment of the governments. We see lots of people giving to charity and going that route. We're actually one of the most generous provinces in the country in terms of people giving to charity, but it just can't fill the gap. We just can't do it that way.
So in your view, do you feel that instead of having charities to fill the gap, that government should be stepping up and doing their part and taking that money that would be regularly given towards charities and put it into a social service, education and planning and everything?
Definitely. What I see is governments should be stepping in and taking responsibility for these issues. We've done it before with things that Canadians really believe in. For instance, public health care. We took an approach that recognizes that health care is a social good, not an individual responsibility, and so we made that investment, and we still very much value it, and it's almost, you know, part of the Canadian identity that we have a public health care system. And so the same thing should happen around poverty reduction, that we should recognize that it's not actually an individual responsibility of people. People are working hard, but the government needs to step in and take responsibility and invest. It's only at that level that we have the funding to invest in social housing and universal childcare that would really make such a difference to the struggles that families are facing in BC.
I've just noticed over the years that there is more of a resistance to tax raises. People feel that they're already taxed enough for on their income and things like that. Is that something that you guys are finding as well, that people are resistant to tax raises? And maybe it's not an issue of taxes being increased, but who those taxes should be placed on?
Right. Yeah, what we've seen actually over the last 10 years or so is that we've gone from having a fairly fair tax system, what we call a progressive tax system, to having a very unfair tax system, a regressive tax system, so that actually people at the top aren't paying as much as a percentage of their income as people at the bottom, which is totally screwed up. So what we've seen is with the personal tax cuts, that most of that benefit's gone to the richest 1%. They've actually had an impact of $41,000 back in their pockets per year, and only about $200 per year goes back to the poorest folks. So when we hear about personal tax cuts, we should really think about who's benefiting. And what we're losing out by doing those personal tax cuts, we're losing about $3 billion per year from our public purse, which is our ability to invest in these kind of social goods that people want and need. And you're right, I think some people balk at tax increases, but it should be targeted to those who can afford it, and we should get back to a fair tax system. Mm-hmm. And we should also, I think people are starting to recognize that our taxes pay for a lot of the things that we want to see in society, the things that we think are good about our communities. And I think people are starting to recognize that the governments have taken away that ability and things are sort of crumbling. Our social services are crumbling right now. We're in a bit of a crisis situation. And so I feel like there's a turnaround happening, and people are recognizing that we need to pay taxes, and that's the price we pay for a civilized society.
Mm-hmm. One of the arguments that I often hear is that taxes on companies and things like that will decrease people investing in Canada, having their headquarters here in Canada, and having these tax breaks actually benefits our economy because it creates jobs. What is your counter argument to that?
Well, I always say that there are other ways to create incentives, and actually a lot of those companies, I mean, we'd have to look into the details of it, but are they hiring local workers? Are they giving their workers living wages, or are they maintaining them on low wages? You know, we need to think about the big picture of those kind of incentives for corporations. Mm. And when we actually look at money going into low-income people's hands, if we took that approach, that money goes right into local economies. Those folks aren't holidaying abroad or saving or investing abroad. You know, it all flows into their local stores and their local services. So that's actually more stimulating to the economy, to put money into low-income people's hands.
So can you lastly outline what your guys' poverty reduction plan is and kind of like a step-by-step basis?
Yes, we've looked at best practices across the country and internationally, and we've pulled together a really exciting comprehensive plan. So it's a lot of what I've talked about. So there are seven pillars to the poverty reduction plan we're asking for. The first two are about raising income. So it's raising welfare rates and disability and raising minimum wage. And then the next five are really about social goods. So it's about building more social housing. And we used to do this. We used to build about up to 1,500 social housing units per year back in the 90s. Now we barely build any per year. It's about investing in universal childcare. Quebec has a $7 a day childcare system, and we're following our childcare partners and pushing for a $10 a day childcare system, and it would be free, completely free for people who earn less than $40,000. We're pushing for more investment in public education at all levels, K-12 and post-secondary education, more community health care, more mental health services. And then lastly, as I said, anything that we do would have to recognize that some groups are facing much higher poverty rates. So, for instance, senior single women, it's one in five of them are facing poverty, which is a huge rate. Queer and trans women also facing a lot of homelessness and food insecurity. And single mothers are facing a poverty rate of almost 50%, so one in two, which is really shocking. So anything we do would have to have specific policies targeted to those groups to make sure that we really could capture the most vulnerable and lift them up.
All right, so if these are things that people, our listeners, are interested in, how can they support the coalition or learn more about it?
Yeah, well, we have a website at bcpovertyreduction.ca, and we've got tons of great resources and lots of ways to get involved there. If people just have a little bit of time and just want to go and send an email to your premier, you can do that right from our website. If you have a bit more time, there's a sample letter to send. So, and more time, we've put together a support kit for people to go and meet their local MLAs with all the background information and anything that you might need to do that. So we've really got tons of resources for people who want to engage at a democratic level and really get involved with asking their government for this. If people live in the Lower Mainland near Vancouver, then they can join our Poverty Reduction Action Committee. There's information about that on our website. If people work or are involved in any kind of organization, they can get their organization to sign the call. So that just kind of adds strength to the call. Like I said, we're 400 organizations strong, and we're continually growing. So that's another way to get involved.
Great. That sounds like there's a lot of options for people to get involved democratically in this process. I really want to thank you for coming on air with me today, Trish, and I wish you all the best luck with the coalition.
Thanks very much for having me on the show.
No problem. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So coming up next, I have Morgan Purvis here in the station with me, and we're going to be talking about Lit Art City. I don't know if I'm saying that right. I'll have to ask her, which is an event that's coming up later this week. And you just heard me talking with Trish Garner, who is a community organizer from the BC Poverty Reduction Coalition. So you're listening to Women on Air on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. So in the studio with me today, I have Morgan Purvis. Hi, Morgan.
Hello.
So it's great to have you here with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. So you are the Youth Poet Laureate of Victoria. What does that mean, and how do you get that title?
It means that I get to do more poetry, basically, which is awesome. I got the title through an application process. It was open applications and, submitted my vision about the program, project ideas about how to work with and for the youth artists in the city, as well as, reviewing my poems. And then there was an interview, and in the end, I ended up here.
That's pretty great. So what was your plan for the youth arts in the city of Victoria?
My biggest project is going to be that the Canadian Festival of Spoken Word is coming here to Victoria in October. It's in a different city across the country every month. And when it comes here to Victoria, we'll be having some pretty intensive youth programming, bringing the national eyes and the national media, which is going to be focused here, to really look at the power of the youth art scene in the city.
Mm-hmm. And where do you see that power manifested? Is it in poetry, or do you find it in just arts and performance, or where is it?
Most of where I see it is in poetry. I'm a poet, and I came up through Victorious Voices and the Raising Voices program, which is what the poetry scene, the spoken word community here in Victoria does in high schools. Just this week, actually, yesterday was the semifinals, and tomorrow night is the finals of the Youth Slam Championships.
Oh, wow.
Which is amazing. Those kids get up there and do stuff that blows me and half the, professional poets I know out of the water, which mm-hmm. is so exciting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you're actually going to be participating in Lit Art City. I think that's how it's pronounced. They're emphasizing the art, so I'm assuming.
I think so.
Yes. So that's going to be taking place this Friday, April 11th at Open Space, mm-hmm. and it's to celebrate National Poetry Month.
Yes.
But can you tell me some of the performances and events that are going to be going on for that evening?
Yeah. Janet Rogers will be performing, which is super exciting. She's our city's poet laureate. Jordan Abel, who is a Niska poet, a very strong poet. Standing Nation Drum, which is a lot of fun. Karen Lee White.
Yeah, that's powwow, isn't it? Or I thought there was a powwow event that's going on as well.
I'm not clear on all of the details.
Yeah, fair enough.
Although it will be very exciting.
Yes, absolutely. So were there other performers as well?
Yeah, we've got Constance Cook Dance, Uminari Taiko, and that is it.
Yeah, so that sounds like it's a pretty packed lineup. Are there still tickets on sale, do you know?
There are, yes.
There are? Okay, so you guys can, if you're interested in listening to some great poetry and seeing some great events, you can definitely get some tickets for that. Again, it's at Open Space. So how did you get involved in poetry? Like, what sparked your interest in poetry?
I always wrote when I was quite young, in elementary school kind of thing. And then later on in my senior years of high school, I exposed to spoken word through, high school slam stuff. My school had a slam team, and I tried out, and kind of that's how it ended up happening. The way I got really inspired was at the BC Youth Slam Championships in Vancouver at a festival called Hullabaloo. I saw Buddy Wakefield perform, who is...
I keep hearing about him in the poetry scene.
Yep, he's coming back to Victoria this May, actually. I'm so excited. Buddy Wakefield sparked my heart, and I was sold as soon as I saw him. I heard one poem and then had to leave the theater and go cry in the bathroom for half an hour.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is it about his poetry that spoke to you so much?
Oh, his delivery. You can never tell if he's bantering or performing. He's so personable and casual. His writing is impeccable. And his themes are all so inspiring and beautiful and really, really gritty without being ugly. It's like he's always covered in dust but smiling.
That's a great analogy for him, I think. So what types of themes do you like to talk about in your poetry?
I write a lot of sort of feminist-ish poetry. Mm-hmm. Those were my first themes. I used to be a real rager. And now I still write a lot of stuff with a very feminine tone, I think. I write about family. I write about love. I'm definitely a spoken word artist, but I sometimes have a little bit more of a softer feel than what you might be used to in the slam scene.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you actually have some poetry to share with us here today. Mm-hmm. Can you share one of your poems with us and do a little bit of an introduction so that people know what it's about?
Sure. This poem is called Daughter. I do not have a child. I'm 21 years old, but I hope to one day have a child. And this is kind of written preemptively, and I talk about it like a gift to moms in general, and my mom especially. Daughter. My hips know already how to rock her gentle, and my fingers know how best to keep her clean. Being the oldest sister has taught me the canonized bookwork of motherhood. Now, Mary was no sexless doll, no toy of jealous macho god. She was made purer in every dripping, bloody, squelching moment. Picking up the lunch dishes in the sink, cleaning them slowly, scrubbing every millimeter, the hum of the refrigerator, breathing sweet lavender bubbles and feeling visceral gratitude for a moment of control, likely to be the only one today. On the day that my daughter is born, I think I'll call her Eve, and I'll breathe her scent so hungrily, sweet, like apples, and special, like a secret seed kept under the tongue. The hidden bits of Eden we keep with us from birth to grave. Looking out the late afternoon window, watching my brothers and sisters squabbling in play, laughing in discovery, and sobbing out whole seas in disappointments unbearable, I spend 3 falls, 1 fight, 2 new dimensions, and a fairy's visit, cleaning this little pile of dishes. In silence, in reverence, and I remember. I remember the tequila-soaked friends of my stepfather, appraising my 15-year-old breasts and ignoring my mother. They were disguised as friendly family men, costumes completed with real live wife and kid accessories. But also, I remember the day after that, when I painted my first giant rainbow vagina, and I taped it to the ceiling in my bedroom. And now, there are a certain sort of good man's men who never asks me what I think, unless I catch him by surprise. But don't worry, Evie. The good man's men are easily surprised by the works of God, and you carry paradise under your tongue.
Wow, that was really great. And what a great poem coming up for Mother's Day that's actually coming up too, that I think that speaks to. So you have quite a few themes there in Christianity or belief in God seems to be a strong theme. Is that something that's really close to you when you write your poetry?
Yeah, a lot of my poetry has a very spiritual theme. I'm not a Christian per se, although I do have recently engaged in quite a bit more study of Christian works. But yeah, a lot of my stuff is a nod to spiritual content for sure.
Mm-hmm. And why is that such an important influencer for you?
Oh, heavens, why is it an important influence for everyone?
Yes, absolutely. Mm. It's a hard one, I think.
Yeah, it's somewhere in the bottom of my belly, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So is poetry something that you study in school, or is it just a hobby on the side for you?
I don't study in school. It's not quite just a hobby. It's hopefully the rest of my life, or at least a big part of it. But no, for now, it's kind of a part-time assist the bills a little bit gig. But mostly it's just what I do that I love. In school, I'm studying business, ironically, I guess. Yeah, with the hopes of making a living one day as an arts producer and a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's a great path you have going there. So we're talking to Morgan Purvis, who is the Victoria Youth Poet Laureate. So again, we're back on air. And so can we just go with what does poetry mean to you? Why is it so important to you? And do you choose to express yourself through this medium?
There are a number of reasons. One of the first is that it's a way to speak. And, you know, please excuse the cliche, but truly, poetry gives us a way to share our voices and really connect. What makes spoken word so powerful is that your performance, your piece, your art is different depending on who the audience is. The way that you look at their eyes or don't, or what the cafe is shaped like, whether how well they can hear you or not, changes the art so dramatically that it's truly like super grounded in connecting with your audience, which to me is so important and special. And I think partially because of that, spoken word becomes a really close community. Really, poets are my family, many of them. You know, Solstice Cafe, where we have our open mics and our slams, that's where I go on a bad day to find my people. And there's a lot of love, even across the country and through people in the States, not across the North American scene. And for the bigger name poets who know each other internationally, there's a lot of love there too, or so I hear. Mm-hmm. So I love that about it as well.
Mm-hmm. So what is it, what audience response do you get from your poetry? What is it that makes you want to keep performing for people?
Ooh. Most of my response, I get a lot of, like, quiet, like, whoa. A lot of my inspirations get, like, the big yells and the wah, wah, the snaps and the screaming. I get that every now and then, but I'm not very funny, which I'm okay with, but I'm working on it. I like touching people. I really like that, like those raw emotional places. I like sharing a feeling with my audience and knowing that we've shared an experience together. So really like taking them through a story and inviting them to feel what I'm feeling.
I find that poetry is a very vulnerable medium. How do you deal with that vulnerability and sharing those parts of you that other people prefer to keep close to their chest?
Yeah, I practice a lot so that, you know, it doesn't all flee my head when I get on stage. That has happened to me many times, and it's not the best. But also, I've learned to be prepared for it, I think. Sometimes it's almost like blacking out after I perform a set or a poem. You know, people want to chat or congratulate me, and you got to give me 10 minutes. I just ripped my stomach open in front of you. I need to go stitch myself back together. I think performing like brand new pieces or things that are particularly vulnerable in front of a community where I feel really safe or where I know I'm going to get a lot of support is important for me, so that I can kind of build up the resilience to do it in a little scarier place.
Mm-hmm. All right, and what events are coming forward for you? What do you do within the poetry community, and how do you contribute?
Well, like I said, this week is Victoria's Voices, which is super exciting. Tonight I'll be at the alumni showcase with Brendan McLeod, who is an incredible Canadian slam champion. He'll be featuring, and then people who've gone through the high school slam scene are going to feature tonight. Then tomorrow's the slam championships. Big event for me, which is coming up, is on May 16th, Buddy Wakefield, who is by far my favorite poet in the world, in contemporary poetry, is going to be performing at Alex Golden Hall with Fish and Bird. And surprise, just brand new news, is that Open Secret, who is the current reigning slam champion for Canada, will very likely be opening the show, which is going to be so exciting. So this is kind of my first endeavor into real big show production. So that's really exciting. And then Buddy will be doing a workshop the next day as well. So I get to host my favorite poet, which is really exciting.
That is really exciting. And I'm just going to remind everybody that Morgan is going to be presenting or performing at the Lit Arts City event that is happening this Friday, which is April 11th from 8 to 10 p.m. at Open Space. Doors are at 7:30 and you guys can get tickets, I think, online.
Yes, that's correct. It's going to be a super awesome, diverse show with a lot of like really high energy sets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's going to be pretty exciting. So I really want to encourage everybody to go out and check that out. And we're going to have one more poem from Morgan. So do you want to introduce that and just go ahead?
For sure. This piece is called Snowflakes. Speaking of more vulnerable work, this is a pretty near and dear one to my heart. And it's a little bit of a painful one, a little bit dark. So I guess as sort of a warning to the listeners, this is Snowflakes. Each winter as the year grows older, we each grow older too. The chill sets in a little colder, the verities we knew seem shaken and untrue. They built us an igloo to keep us warm and strong, and we were to be the next generation of builders, ice engineers in the making. We were the snowflake special sponge middle classroom gifted education. And there are 100,000 too many ways to say that my heart aches, and there are chills in my bones. And any other cliche you might say to express, to pass from my own body, my heartstrings, to somebody else, the tremors that shake me. Screams and jumps and tears, and I am not the only one who cut myself, and I run as fast as I can. And she offed herself. Panic is so consuming, I lose consciousness, and fury so fierce, I could lose it with this, and I don't understand, and I can't hold it in, and it's coming, and I'm not breathing, and this passion, this ecstasy, is too many much for me. We were so loved. Who can blame them for being unable to save us from our own frailty? She is like the swallow that flies on high. She is like the river that never runs dry. She is like the sun beaming on the lee shore. I love my love, but my love is no more. On February 2, 2010, the most special snowflake chose to melt in Ross Bay. The suicide of Freya Mill marked us all, leaving asymmetrical fractures in our crystals. And since then, I've received the news of 7 more attempted meltings by the gifted madness graduating class of 2011. And since then, most of the rest of us have been medicated. ADD, OCD, GAD, ADHD, CD, BP, chemical flakes like so much frozen acid rain. We were to replenish the aquifers. We were to gift back the forests from the pine beetles. We were to restore this modern winter. We were so loved, and there is no one to blame. Yet, I believe beyond believing that life can spring from death, that hope can flower from our grieving, that we can catch our breath and turn transfixed by love.
So So we are just at the end of the show of Women on Air, and we had Morgan Purvis on the air just before we went to that song by Valerie June called Trials, Troubles, and Tribulations. Morgan is going to be performing at the Lit Art City event that is this Friday, April 11th. I really want to encourage everybody to go out. All the proceeds are going to be supporting the Victoria Reed Society, which promotes literacy, reading, writing, and math in the community. So if that's something that interests you, definitely go out and get a ticket.